Bit about a little bit of history of our legal fight in the union with the forces that oppose us, and kind of just giving a little bit of a background. Not everything, because it would take a long time. Just give you an idea of what the union's been up against for all these years. In the very early beginning of the movement, of course, we didn't have either the money or we didn't have the interest in among the people who joined support us to have an attorney. So we used to have attorneys that would come in and work like 2-3 days and then run home to San Francisco or Los Angeles, and then an attorney would come back and try to take care of that case, and it was a total desmadre, you know. And I mean really train them so that they can handle all those things, that all the administrative hearings, know how to interview witnesses, how to get information, how to investigate, the things that are important. And we would have two sets of paralegals. One set that would fit into the ALRB, which would be pretty specialized here. Another set that would fit into litigation and this work here. And one set later on that should fit into another form we call the Campesino Centers. And that would be separate. Then the apprentices. As you know, I think we're the only organization in the recent past 40, 45 years that graduated an apprentice. Tom Dalstell joined the union. He was, who got him? You got him, Richard, or Gilbert? Gilbert got him in the boycott. He just out of high school and came, and I think he had 2 years of college, and joined Jerry and became an apprentice and became an attorney, passed the bar and everything. He did it in 4 years, and it was kind of news in California, because it hadn't happened in 40 years. So we want to start out with a few people here. We have in the union now people who I think could do it, who've been around the union and who we're very good to get them. And then the continued education of the attorneys. The attorneys who are there continue to upgrade and continue to learn more and more about the law and about the... So that would be... The House Counsel would not be part of this. It would be attached to my office somewhere apart from this. But this would be the four divisions, and each one of these would then have, like here, that would be totally involved in the ALRB, and maybe there's legislation in other states that would come under here. Litigation, of course, there would be all the litigation in the union. This is in the pre-planning stage. We would not move this in the next 2 years or so, but we got to be thinking about it. This would like to start doing it right away. So I think in terms of dollars, in terms of effort, I think the little department, it's. I think we have the collective bargaining department, we have organizing, and I think that comes right after that. I think it comes number three. To show you an idea how much legal, every union, I don't know of any union doesn't complain about attorneys, except about every union complains about attorneys. We went to the auto works the other day, and they were complaining about their attorneys. I mean, there's just a labor leaders are just supposed to complain about attorneys. That's kind of, but see, what happens is that the relationship is different. It's a relationship where the attorney works independently, and then he takes cases and does it for a fee here. And that creates, the unions today aren't doing all the legal work that they could be doing. When an employer comes after a union, the union takes a look at it and says, oh, wow. They want $20, and to defend ourselves it costs $40. Let's pay them $20. That's what I do. That's exactly how they do it. The employers then begin to, they use it more creatively than the unions are. And so that the poor, in this case, very specifically the farm worker in his attempts to organize, needs the services, and they cannot do it without an attorney. That's, you know, they can do a lot of it, but not everything, because anything you can gain in the picket line, or anything you can gain across the table, can be lost in a court battle easily. I mean, that's... And the other side has more money, they have more attorneys, they have very good attorneys. We don't like them, but they're smart. They're tough, they're smart, they know. And we may not like them, and the more we don't like them means the smarter they are. And sometimes they do a job on us, sometimes... But we want to have a reputation like we had having the best attorneys around. We do have a good reputation at this point, but we gotta even up that and get a, so that in a, when an attorney thinks of taking the union, when a grower thinks about taking the union in a legal fight, they gotta think like, oh shit, you know, we're gonna get a lot of trouble. That's what they gotta think. So that's like half of the fight, you know. I think that's the end of my little talk. But Michael will follow, but before he does that, if you have any questions, any suggestions, I'd like to answer them now. Yes?
Just a question. It seems to me that with the move of the attorneys to here, there may be a transition period where you have a lot of trainee, fresh off the boat attorneys, and perhaps a question that's maybe DeMarco is to not maybe enough attorneys to kind of get them up to shit speed. In other words,
they'll be, yeah.
Mm-hmm. They'll be.
Yeah, what we'll do is we'll either, well, there's various ways of doing it. We can postpone the cases and get continuances, or we can go and take the case for a fee to an attorney until we get, you know, in shape. But we need to deal with that transition, you're right. But the we had a good experience with young attorneys. We haven't had, we've had, oh, some bad experiences, but not generally very good. There's a lot of enthusiasm there. There's a lot of willingness to learn. And those two things can get you across a lot of the hard, you know.
Yeah, I'm kind of interested in the prepaid legal branch that you've outlined. But you said that's kind of a long range plan at this point.
Yeah.
Is it long range because of union priorities right now, or is it long range because of economics?
Economics primarily. Well, primarily economics, yeah.
If it's economics, then I mean I can understand you want it under the legal department, but I could also see it fitting in under the MLK Press Fund somehow, you know, to the Campesino Centers.
Yeah.
Would it be feasible to do economically to do it that way for a while?
No, because there's not enough money there to do it. See, we could do some of, for instance, we could have like one or two attorneys to guide the Campesino Center workers to do the, you know, the work that they do, you know, but to provide legal services, no, there's not enough money there.
It's amazing, you know, the amount of money that a personal injury case takes, you know, to really up the amount. It's quite an investment, you know. Even in a minor case, you gotta get specialists, you know, and all that really adds up a lot. So I think that's one of the main reasons we're, you know, saying that.
But I think that we can get, for instance, all of the work that would come to us, there would be not some personal injury, but a lot of just like people being drunk, people. Getting accused of narcotics, members getting accused of this, that, criminal cases, and that would be like, once you start doing that and the doors are open, they just flock in, you know. We think we can do it on a, this would take like a planning grant first and do a real planning job, so when we offer the services, people will know exactly what we're offering. Probably start like we started the medical plan or like we started the pensions with a small, not offering everything, but some things, and keep upgrading. As we get more money, we do more and more, you know. But it's needed. Yes.
This question might be better directed to Jerry Cohen, but maybe you can give me the beginnings of an answer. I'm interested in the litigation area, where you see the union going as far as supporting the offensive efforts, the organizing efforts, the next few years, what kinds of things you see them union needing in terms of litigation?
Well, there's all kinds of fights. For instance, boycott action, there's all kinds of restrictions, injunctions that they bring or try to bring against us, suits that emanate out of the effort. In the strike situation, see, if you get into a strike, you get into a boycott, and you generate just loads of work and do things. Defensive work because they're after you, but also offensive work. For instance, there's an injunction right now, several injunctions in the Imperial Valley right now. So you got to defend the injunctions. But in the course of that, some people were beaten up. And so we gotta then do the offensive too. It's like an endless, it's like a river. Once you get into a fight, once you get into a strike, once you get into a boycott, it's just like, I don't know, have you know how much work there is over there?
Quite a bit.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
And so that we always said that the offensive work should be directly related, should not be in a vacuum like research. We had a lot of problems with research because people would come and research the oranges. And that was 10 years before we were ready to do oranges, but we did it because they wanted to do that. Then the research was pegged to gathering information. And we said, well, that's no. We need information to be able to make decisions, not information for the sake of information. The same thing with litigation in terms of the offensive litigation should be not because it's a big case or not because it's like, you know, it's like impact case, but it's a class action. You know, maybe it's good, but no, we want to file cases that directly support what the workers are doing right then, you know? That's the kind of stuff. And the work that the union does really guides you. See, what the workers are doing, what's being done to them in when you get into those confrontations, really guides you so what has to be done.
So I think maybe what my question is going to is what kinds of struggles do you see the union getting into that are going to need the support of litigation?
Okay, here in California, we need, on an ongoing basis, we need to take care of all the appeals that will come out of the ALRB. They will appeal, some growers will appeal that, and those are major decisions that they hold up a lot of the things. That's one. The other thing that'll happen is there'll be test cases on the ALRB testing the various provisions. We got to take care of that. Michael maybe has more ideas on this. Then we have the countersuits. We filed in litigation a suit for assault, whatever. Then they filed another one back at us, or two more. So we have the offensive and defensive there. But we also have to deal with the appeals. Like right now, we're involved in an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court in other states. And then all the work in other states, once we start organizing, there's just a whole bunch of work that comes up. So that doesn't take into consideration what else would there be?
Well, I was just thinking along the lines of the ALRB, although we have an act, you know, the act does contain a clause which specifically refers to the NLRB precedents. Section 1148, I think. And so although we have the law, we have, in many instances, things that haven't been decided yet. You know, and we're not that, you know, really happy with precedents that would be applicable under the NLRB. They just don't fit the agricultural setting. You know, so the law actually is being formed. You know, so that goes along with that sort of thing. But that's an ongoing job here in California. But, you know, the key is, again, you know, creativity, you know. We've got to sit down, we've got to see what the policies are for the union, you know, and those, of course, aren't set by us. But once we get that key in, you know, then we have to use our brains and just get things together. The growers' attorneys, you know, are more and more using just a lot of tricks, you know. They're making use of a lot of the Bankruptcy Act, filing under Chapter 11 for reorganization.
Oh, that's a whole...
That's a whole new thing, you know, just to get away from your responsibilities.
Who's an employer still not defined? Who's an employer, agricultural employer in California still not defined? You've got employers, you've got corporations, you've got partnerships, you've got
associations,
management. You've got management, farm management, corporations, and on and on and on. And where does it stop? Where does it end? For instance, you win an election. This farm management corporation manages 80 small citrus growers. Well, next year, 10 of those growers says, I don't want to be with this, I'm going to go over there because it's cheaper. They just take up and go and leave this one. And our argument is that they belong to the union, not out there, as an example. Or that we went to one case in Fresno and the guy says, oh, I'll negotiate, but I don't have any workers now. The business was bought by my son. His son now bought his business. Ah, it's endless, all that stuff, right? Who's an attorney? I mean, who's a grower is one case. The other one is how do we plug all those holes, you know. All those cases are going to go to the courts. Endless stuff.
And by looking at the law, you know, you can find really neat tricks, you know, on how to deal with it. Like, for instance, there's, in Delano especially, there's a lot of threat, you know, of growers going into a reorganization under Chapter 11. And that's just, you know, one more area of expertise that I wasn't, you know, I just don't have the time to get into that, right? So I looked at the, you know, the law, and it says that if you get a creditors committee elected, okay, you have the power to hire an attorney. And the grower, in essence, is the one that's going to pay for that attorney. So we did that. We filed under the three plans that we have, and we got nominated as a creditors committee. Then I went to L.A., and I got an expert in the field who's charging the grower $60 to handle the case. See? So now all I have to do is make sure that he's doing the work, and ultimately we get paid. See? So you have to find those tricks, and they're there. It's just a question of, you know, finding them, making use of them. I'd like to, can I go ahead and ask?
Sure.
One of the things that, you know, as you know, I just, some of you may know, I got back from San Diego, and that's probably one of the, I think it's about the eighth school that we've been to recruiting. And time again, you know, there's two things that are in most people's mind when they get out of law school. Okay, it's money, and secondly, it's what kind of experience they're going to be able to get, you know, to increase, of course, their competence in the field. And you know, this is from the beginning. I started recruiting about 3 months ago, and I've had to sit back and just start thinking about, you know, what the lawyer's role in the society is, you know. And I've started like tripping out, you know, thinking about ancient societies and, you know, looking at the roles that people in those societies had, you know, which are somewhat similar to what we have in this society with lawyers. And I sort of tripped out on the, you know, in the old ancient civilizations, you had priests, you know. You had, even before that, witch doctors. And they sort of held a secret amount of information, you know, that the most of the society didn't have, you know. And it sort of made them key in the society. Well, it seems to me in this society we have the same thing, you know, lawyers. We're privy to information that can, you know, it's pretty potential. You can hurt, you know, or you can help. Okay? And one of the things that's directly related to that, I think, is, especially in this society, the capitalist society, okay, that you get paid for the knowledge you have. Okay? And unfortunately, a lot of people that come out of professional schools equate competence with the amount of money they get. Okay, that's a very serious mistake, especially when you're thinking of helping people, poor people. Okay, because that's not the way it's supposed to work. If you really look at it, you know, and a lot of you, I'm sure, because you're here, you know, really want to help poor people. But I think, you know, I'm just going through that thing of, okay, is that true? You know, you go up, and like Caesar says, you know, the growers are hiring really, you know, top-notch attorneys, you know, professional representation. And we have to go up against that. You know, so we have to destroy these myths about, you know, if you get paid so much, you know, you're going to be competent. If not, you know, you're somewhere in the middle area. The ABA just did a survey on those various areas of the law and attorneys of practice in those areas. And the result of it was that tax attorneys get paid more, okay, and they're the most respected. Okay. We also happen to know that those attorneys are the ones that lie the most. So in terms of integrity, the profession looks down at tax attorneys, right? So then in the poverty law area, those people, integrity-wise, are looked up to. But the profession looks at them, probably because of the amount of money they get, as being sort of incompetent. Okay, and that, you know, the legal department, the union, has proven untrue. So please destroy those myths from your mind. One of the other things is that with the question that you asked, you know, about what position are we going to be in, you know, with a lot of new attorneys.
No, my question was just a transitional training period. That's
yeah. Okay, well, like Caesar said, you know, what we may have to do at the beginning is decentralize the department, you know, farm out some of the cases and, you know, depending on the amount of attorneys we can get, you know. we'll start work on the others. But our idea, and I think the reason the union attorneys have progressed, you know, a lot faster than you would in an ordinary law firm, is that our idea is that an attorney that comes on, okay, regardless of experience, should get right into the job, you know, and just start from scratch. But what we want to set up, along with the paralegal program, the apprenticeship program, is a very strong continuing education program for the attorneys. We've got to have that, and it is key. You know, so we're going to be working more and more along those lines. Okay, it entails, for instance, like, okay, not all of us in law school take, you know, like trial courses, okay, how to handle a trial. We would have to do that. Or, for instance, we may take a labor law course, but we may not have taken an ALRB course, you know, because they're just not offered. So we would have to offer that. You know, and there's a lot of ways we could do that. We can do it, like, with attorneys that have worked very closely with us in the past, you know, in that field. They would come in and we would offer a seminar, you know, for the attorneys we have.
Would these hours be good for the continuing education courses at the board, at the ABA, whoever requires? Like, you got to have, what, every 2 years or something, there's so many continuing education hours that's required to maintain.
Yeah, we could probably get credit for that, you know. It'd be a question of just notifying whatever agency, you know, the California Bar Association and the ABA. Yeah, it's a good idea. We can work that out. In terms of the paralegal program, the idea there is to get like one attorney to work from the get-go, you know, with 10 or 12 young people that have already been, you know, time-tested with a union. And right now we're in the process of developing the curriculum for these 10 people who... The first program will be directed to practice before the ALRB, which fortunately doesn't require one to be an attorney. But that attorney would go through the about a six-month intensive training program with them. Okay, and some of the courses we're looking into are like basic evidence course, administrative procedure, civil procedure, labor law, of course, both NLRB, NLRA, and ALRA, writing, legal research, you know, so. When we take this, you know, this group of students through the 6 months, by the time they get out, they'll be ready to go and be placed in the, you know, various, just like we did with the negotiators, by the way. That was the first class that was graduated about 2 months ago. And in spite of the immense pressure that Caesar had, you know, to have people out there already, because we had so many certified elections, you know, he had to place a halt to that and say, no, we're going to do it this way now. And so since then, we've been getting into education programs. And we're going to do it, you know, with this department. It's going to be no exception. I was interested just when I came in, how many of you are third year students at this point? Three? Four. Second year students? And graduates? Cinco. It's pretty evenly divided.
Do you have any other questions?
I was just curious, this wasn't really directly relevant to anything we've been talking about, but how do you feel about the political composition of the Agricultural Labor Relations Board? Do you feel that it's been impartial or fair to you?
You know, the best board was the first board. The very interesting development, I think, as we see it, you know, is that once a good guy gets appointed, he doesn't remain a good guy for too long, you know. Because
the unions operate that well, that way as well, you know. Like the UAW has a program where they have about five attorneys in their general counsel's office, amazingly, you know. And then each of the regionals hires their own attorneys. You know, they're not they're not working directly with the regional, but they're retained. The structure of the legal department in most cases reflects the structure of the organization of the corporation. And where you have a centralized corporation, you will have a centralized legal department. And what that means is that you'll have a large legal general counsel's office, you know, servicing all of your departments within that corporation. One of the things that, you know, oftentimes you have to watch for is that any legal department in any organization, you know, is a department. Like Caesar said, it's a, you know, it's a compartment in the ship. You know, so if you have to have that deeply ingrained in your mind so you don't start, you know, wagging the dog. Do you have any questions?
I was going to ask about your trip to talk to other union leaders, whether you feel that given the pretty rightward shift in most labor unions in the country, that UFW can learn a lot from other unions or what you have learned in the
country. Interesting enough, they're very frightened by the right shift of the country. They're very frightened. And I think while it's a bad thing for workers to have the people, the country going to the right, which it is going to the right, it's not a bad thing getting people, getting unions to begin to. I see some of the big unions, you know, knowing that they've got to do something. The encouraging, really encouraging things are like the, they just elected a new president for the machinist union, and the guy is a rock'em sock'em guy, you know, and he's, and the UAW, of course, has always been up there. The teachers union is okay, and the FSME, those unions are more, you know. But as it comes to us, we're like they love us. I mean, the only union that wouldn't cooperate with the teachers now they'll cooperate with us. See, what we did, something for the labor movement without knowing. We didn't plan it that way; it just happened. We gave them like a reason for being in the 60s and the 70s, and they think in the 80s. We sent a couple of guys to a training class in Washington for a week, and one just got back and was telling me that the moment they said, we got two brothers from the farm workers, everybody's like, man, they came over and they gave them cards, and they said, I'm going to boycott lettuce and offering, you know, we have that kind of a very good rapport with unions. You know, they supported us. They gave us 90% of the almost $40 million that we've spent in building the union has come from labor. A lot of money. Yeah, about that much. So they have it. They're the ones that have the money. and they'll give it to you. See, labor unions vary all over the land, but one thing that they are solid, it is the whole question of right to have a union. If you're fighting for a right to have a union, there isn't one union that I know of that's going to back off from that fight. Now, the right to have a bigger pension plan, well, you know, it's not too important. The right to have more wages, it's important, you know. But when it comes down to the, like in our case, the right to have a union, labor leaders get very excited about that. I mean, because that's the bread and butter kind of stuff, you know, that things are made of. So, and we're in that stage where union, we're building a union, and we have a lot of support. We sent one of our guys to Los Angeles to talk to Los Angeles Federation, which just happens to be pretty big. And the word was just fantastic. The guy said, the director said, the Robertson said, right away he made a program he wants to get involved immediately. Sent out a letter right that day on his name asking for food and money, delegations, legal help. They're very good. In this kind of a fight, right? They're good, yeah. Also, we help them. We help a lot of unions, for instance, and they never forget it. We help the rubber workers once in a big fight. They had about 1,800 workers in the Mattel plant in LA, and they were trying to throw them out. So I went with a group of farm workers. This was a long time, it was about 10 years ago. And they were lost, and we came in, and because a lot of Chicanos there, and we had a good name with them, we turned it around, we got them to vote to keep the union. And they'll never forget that. Never. From the highest officer all the way down, when you went to Ohio, Michigan, anywhere, well, they just go out and they do a lot of things for you. In fact, every Christmas they come and they'll come and have a Christmas party for us here. I mean, you know, but they do a lot of other things. They'll never forget it. So we have a very good in with it. There's some bad unions, but generally they're all very good in that way. Now when you start getting into foreign relations, that's a different, you know. There's all kinds of variations there. But when you stick to the central theme of the union, they're very good. So we expect them, they'll help us.
Do you think the other unions are ready to follow the farm workers' lead and start organizing unrepresented workers?
They can't because they don't have the money. That's our fight to do things that we're doing, because we're convinced that we don't have the money either. No, they can't. Let me give you an example. It costs, the only ones organizing workers are the Teamsters right now. All the other unions are having one hell of a time. They're losing workers, as you know. The Teamsters are winning because the Teamsters organize from the top down. And they do it because they've got the strategic position of transportation. For instance, the workforce is increasing. The labor unions aren't keeping increase. That isn't that they don't want. Let me just give you an example of what the unions pay their organizers something like $65,000 a year. That includes the expense and the wages and the benefits and the pensions, the whole works, about this much. And it's going to about $80,000, I guess, in the next convention, which will be...
It'll take hold of them.
You know
what I mean? You're not saying they pay them that in salary.
No, but they pay them... That's the cost to the union.
Of having an organized...
Yeah, there. But it'll pay them about $40,000, $50,000, or whatever, you know. Their precedents range anywhere from like 100... What is the Teamster? 180,000?
Yeah.
180,000 to 10 bucks a week.
Declaration.
Whatever, you know. Then the other unions, like the FLCO unions, they're cheapskates. It costs them about 48,000 to organize. The membership is dropping. The members are not agreeing to more dues. So very interesting. Some unions are paying $8 per month dues, and they've been doing that for 10 years, and the members won't pay more money. And the unions need money because of the inflation. And they don't, so they're having to cut back. They cannot organize workers. They don't have, some do. You take the big industrial unions like the UAW has money. The steel workers have money. The machinists have money. And a few others, but not too many. and they can organize. Because see, they look at, to organize, say, 50 workers here, it would cost them a shitload of money. Plus, then they organize and they gotta go, they get involved in a huge legal fight, and it winds up in the Supreme Court 10 years later. And then if you get them organized, you got 50 times 8. And they say, look, money-wise, we can't do it. And the trap is that they pay, they try to compete with management. If management pays their guys so much, we'll pay our guys so much. Like, you know, it's interesting, true story, when the guy from Seattle was the president of the Teamsters, ¿cómo se llamaba este? Dave Beck. They were at a convention, and Dave Beck was getting then, the president of the United States was then Truman, and Truman was getting, you recall those days, the president of the USA, of the United States, was getting 100,000 plus so much for expense. And so then, and Dave Beck was getting 80,000. And this is just going up from 75,000, like a year before, but the convention came after. He was getting 80,000. So there's a motion. Guy got made a motion. I make a motion. No president gets more than our president. And they went up to 125,000. And he's always been up. He gets more money than the president of the United States. That's kind of a rule that they have. No president gets more money than our president. That's what, you know, really, that's what they do. So they haven't got the money. They don't have the money to organize. They just barely have money to stay alive and keep what they've got, maybe. They don't. It's a sad thing, and they're not going to have it unless they don't do anything with volunteers anymore. Everything is paid. Everything is paid. We cannot organize workers ourselves. If we paid ourselves wages, however, we would not organize. There's no money to organize. It's just, in other words, in this society, anything to help workers, any organization, be it union, be it whatever, it's very expensive. And the reason poor people don't have organizations is they can't afford them. That's what happens, you know.
So the lesson we learned from labor is not to follow them.
Well, it's okay, see, but they get into a trap because there's the returns begin to be, you know. And there's a lot of mergers going on. Like, for instance, the meat cutters are merging with the clerks. That alone is gonna bring a union of about 1.5 million. They're now telling me, the labor leaders I talk to frequently on the phone or visit with whatever, that they don't see any union under 300,000 members cannot make it right now. And they're all looking for to wait. We've had in the last, there were 144 unions when we started 15 years ago. There's less than 90 now. They're merging every year because of that.
Does that mean in like 10 to 20 years from now, the unions will probably be like conglomerates?
Yeah. If you want to call it, yeah. There'll be probably 10 basic unions in the country. Yeah. They just can't make it.
It's a dollar and cent.
Yeah, it's that same thing. See, they're in the market like anybody else, and they can't afford it. Plus, they may also be some real, truly international unions. We'll be one. We may not be the first one, but we're going to be an international union. We're going to organize workers in other countries. We know we can, and we want to do it. But that'll be a little while yet.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
I wonder to what extent, though, your model of the voluntaristic system presents a challenge or a threat to the other unions. In other words, they have their own structure.
Well, they can change, see, even though, and they, see, it boggles their mind. We had here the director of the education department for the rubber workers last week. And we told them what we were doing. It's just like, they can't comprehend it. Because it's something very different from there. Like, I can't comprehend a guy getting 180,000 to help you. I can't, I mean, I can't even count that far, you know. But it's just like, how do you don't, because out of your experience.
That's funny.
They like that. They said, man, if we could only get our people to come to a meeting without having to pay them, we'd be in good shape. That's what you get. That's how far it gets.
See,
it's ridiculous.
Who was the guy who came the other day and talked to us in a meeting?
That's That's from the...
The rubber workers?
Rubber workers.
Yeah. He was at dinner with us, you know, and we were talking to him, you know, about, he was asking questions about how we work here and how we live and stuff. And then he found out I was an attorney, you know, and right away he offered me a job, you know. It's a trip.
Oh, no, it's true. See, people here, if I tell you the people that we have here, see, there's a going around in certain government circles and in almost all unions, foreign and domestic, that if you work for the farm worker, you must be very good. And we've got people now that, people that here we wouldn't, well, you know, people here that were so inept that they weren't even good enough to be assistants, much less directors, wind up in unions having big jobs with the government. I'm telling you. And really, we have a lot of that. We have people in the British unions. We have people in the German unions. People in the, of course, in Israel, in various operations over there, including the union. We have people. Half of the people organized in the South probably were with us at one time or another. And it's the labor movement. It's a good movement, but you know, it's they develop along those lines, and they're having a hard time because losing money. That they're being shrunk because they can't organize because the law is very bad to organize, but also because of the automation and the mechanization that they're confronted with, and they're having they cannot organize poor workers. It's not they don't have the money to organize poor workers. It just can't be done. They won't do it unless they find a way, a different way of crushing.
Yeah, what's the union planning to do on the mechanization issue, I guess also as it relates to the University of California's role in that? What are you doing now or planning to do in the future about that, either legally or through political means?
Legally, there's little we can do, I guess. Politically, we have a big job to do. The thing is, we don't know exactly what to do. We've been wrestling for at least 5 years with it, 4 or 5 years. We still don't see real daylight because what do you do? I mean, what, for instance, other unions get a lot of money for the workers, they get it like a separation pay, they call it a severance pay, and then they get some, the ones that stay get a big increase in their wages, but you really didn't solve it. And that's not solving it. To train people, what are you training for? There's unemployment everywhere you go, so there aren't any jobs, you know. The American mentality is very strong, very disciplined about progress. See, we don't have any support publicly. We tried it, but we know that we don't see. The American mind generally says, if you have a machine, an invention, that's progress. Irregardless of what happens to the people that the machine happens to eat up or screw up, you know, or take the jobs, they say, well, something will happen there. But they don't really, really, as a nation, you know, as a people, we're enamored with machines. We think machines are great things, you know, and when a machine comes, whatever the purpose, whatever the form, the size, it's good. So we have one hell of a time. We don't have public support for it. We have one hell of a time. So legislatively also, because of no lack of support, I don't know. I wish I had an answer. None of us. We've been wrestling with it for a long time, and we don't know. To say no machines is what we'd like to say, and what we say, and what we have in some contracts. We still have no machines after some bloody fights. But if we start fighting for no machines, we don't build a union.
So you're, if I remember right, I don't remember where I read it, but through the media, I remember reading a statement that you made, which I think was something to the effect of that the union is not opposed to progress in and of itself, but it believes that things should be done to take care of the bad side effects.
Right.
So that's kind of the position.
That's the position we came at. The real position is we would like to have machines, but we don't have anybody to support us there. Oh, the workers would be, you know, but we're really by ourselves.
Well, would there be a possibility of getting support for changing some of the research in the University of California towards developments which aren't really highly technological?
Probably, see, but see, mechanization, as you know, it hits us a little differently. When you automate a conveyor belt, you know, when you automate a factory, you're not talking about, say, when you mechanize agriculture, you're really talking about the harvesting end of things. That's where all the work comes. If you can find a way of harvesting the crop with a machine, you really wreck the whole industry, the whole workforce, so that mechanization agriculture is, it's a lot worse than any mechanization you can think of in any of the industrial sector. It's no comparison. Because, see, generally, mechanization in agriculture deals with, mostly it'll deal with a lot of things, but mostly with the harvesting. That's where the worker is. That's where the worker works, where he makes his money. If you can find a machine to do the harvesting, what else is there to do, you know, really? You know what I mean? So it really hits us hard. And this unit is going to be hit by it and maybe wrecked by it. I don't know. But also the other question people say, like I had an interview with the Washington Post yesterday, and the guy said, well, yeah, but if you ask for more wages and better working conditions, does that mean that machines are going to come in sooner? And I said, no. The machines will come as soon as the growers can develop them. Because there were no unions when the cotton was mechanized, no unions when the tomato was mechanized, no unions when any of those things were mechanized. It had nothing to do with it. The employers will put them as soon as they can get them. That's a tough question. That's a tough question for us. I don't know how to deal with it. I don't know.
Yes. Are you doing any work on the question of the 160 acre limit and agriculture? And, it seems to me that might be an arena for more jobs in the valley.
Well, we went to the it's interesting stuff. We went to the workers in the ones that are on strike now, and we talked about 160 limitation. We had a frank discussion, and they weren't like all of us non-workers see the 160 very clear, right? We apply it and we break up. Man, they had a lot of questions we couldn't answer. The workers did. What happens to my job? It was, well, we don't know. Well, yeah, but what happens? Because you break up my company. It's a good liberal issue, but it's not a, maybe not a good worker issue. The workers see it in a different perspective. I was shocked. I mean, I was not shocked, but I was really surprised that I never thought, because, well, who would be against 160 limitation? We should just cut them up, you know. The workers began to ask all kinds of questions that dealt with their own personal interests very directly. So nothing came of it. I mean, we just knew that we were going to sell them on the idea. Versus, okay, what happens if they break up this ranch and there's 1,200 of us working, you break it up into small portions of 160 acres? There'll be less jobs. Well, yeah. Well, what happens to me? What is the union going to do about my job? Well, we don't know. Well, it's an enlightening thing. So, they want to know, for instance, what do I get out of 160-acre limitation? What are my jobs? Oh, well, all those things. What about my seniority? What about my pension? What about my, all those things? It was very interesting. Couldn't answer the questions. Because they were looking to the union and saying, well, then, you need to provide jobs. Because we haven't got jobs. We don't have jobs. Well, then, it's pretty interesting. It got that far and then it was dropped. We dropped it. We couldn't supply the answers that they were seeking. And there was, you know, like, well, let's do it cooperatively. To do a cooperative venture which would work would take endless amount of money. It would be like a whole new thrust for the union. The 160 limitation, in the Fresno area, the workers are solid. They want it broken up. In the Imperial Valley, not so. At least the ones we talked to. The leadership, they're not so sure that it's a good thing to do.
Why is it that the workers have different, in the two areas, have different views on that?
They're organized down there, and they have a seniority, they have a system, they have a union. Over here, they're not organized. Probably. I don't know. Maybe this. See, the land in Imperial Valley is not as big as this. These guys hold 80,000 acres. Imperial Valley, the biggest landholder would be maybe 5,000. That would be very large. And Salinas is even more. So Salinas, 1,000 acres would be a large landowner probably. I'm not sure, but it's not. West Fresno County, 15,000, 10,000, 80,000, 30,000 is not unusual.
Queens is also owned by a big oil company, so that makes a lot of difference.
Yeah.
The land over there.
Yeah, it's true.
It's owned by, you know, by Standard Oil, Tenneco, you know, all these big giant oil companies, where the growers of the Pearl Valley are, you know, 4 or 5 people, you know, growers, and not so much the multinational corporation.
That might be, I don't know, that might be a reason.
Is a large percent of the people that you are organizing now in Imperial Valley undocumented?
No.
Yeah.
No, Imperial Valley, the areas close to the border are not undocumented. The undocumented workers are inland. In Imperial Valley, we're running a list down for the food stamp and all that stuff, and I don't think we came across, I just went through about a couple of hundred names asking. We didn't come across anyone that was not legal. They're all legal. And so is the case in San Isidro, what they call the southern part of the county. Those jobs are held by legal people. Now, once you move away from that, then that's different.
Yeah. Are you organizing them anymore?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, see, when we organize anyone who's working in the farm. Doesn't matter whether legal or illegal, it doesn't really matter. We organize. In some cases, we run into places where 100% of our illegal when we go to organize a place. And they're not the strong, they're very afraid, because you know, because they're undocumented, they have a lot of fears and it's harder to organize. But we can get confused and interested. And sometimes we also have some reservations because we don't know if we do them good or bad. We organize them, sometimes they'll take them up, you know. And so instead of helping them, in that case, you screw them up, you know. There's a lot of uncertainties there. But see, the places where the jobs are year-round and the better jobs, you don't find too many illegals. You find illegals in the fringe jobs and the jobs that, like, other people don't want, you tend to find them there a lot more. But the vegetable industry, in Arizona, in Imperial Valley, a lot less, a little bit more in Salinas. When you get in Salinas, you'll find a few more illegals there, but not that much. Now, when you get into jobs like olives and strawberries and the fringe jobs, a lot of them.
You talked a little bit earlier about cooperatives. I was curious whether you see that as something which would eventually be a preferable way of arranging the work situation when the workers do control the farms.
I do. See, that's the only way I see right now where technology will help the worker. But there's also a big problem there is that you make an employer out of work, and so where are you, you know? So you have to be careful you're not making employers out of workers, because they'll turn out and they'll act like employers. And then we have the other problem.
Hasn't it been true in most cooperative situations that hasn't happened?
No, it's been true that it does happen. It does happen. Unless you have a real strong seed. I've done a lot of research and a lot of talking, a lot of visiting of cooperatives, and I can get very excited about them. But what we have in this country, we don't have real cooperatives in the sense of farming cooperatives other than the religious groups or semi-religious groups. Other than that, we don't have any real big cooperatives. And the biggest cooperative movement in the United States, and it's not known as a cooperative, but in fact it is, because people tend to look at them as a religious sect. But the Hutterites are the big ones. They're very big, very big. And they own land in the Dakotas. So much now that there are state laws preventing them from buying land. And they also right across the border in what they call the plain provinces in Canada. They also have legislation preventing them from buying land. And that's about it. And in this country, you have a Well, there was one that got very... So what they do in cooperative, they do farming, and then for some reason, they began to do manufacturing to kind of take the winter months into account and kind of, you know, and then, like the Amana freezer is a good example. That was done by one of those religious sects. That was those were the black hats.
Mennonites.
The Mennonites. Well, the Mennonites did that. And boy, they got very wealthy. And now they got a huge enterprise. The Amana, it's a big enterprise. So they forgot about farming. They don't even have a religious community. Now it's their businessmen, and they fight the union. They do all those things that good businessmen do. And there are some cooperatives in California, but there are most of them are where our members, and they, like in Salinas, they have a strawberry cooperative. But they stop at the crucial point. They do for instance, if that's 100 acres there, they'll probably have maybe say 20 people owning 5 acres each, and so they cut it up, and they cooperate like in developing the land. They cooperate like in buying fertilizer and selling, but the essential is the production. They don't cooperate. The production is not cooperative, so it's not really a cooperative. So some of those guys have hired illegal and paid him pretty bad wages to break the cross, you know.
Yeah, that happened very, very clear to me. I'm negotiating with a grower called Victor Wright. He owns 200 acres of strawberries. So what happened was that the co-ops were putting pressure on the grower not to pay a lot of money, okay, to the workers, because they had to pay more, you know, a certain amount of money to the workers they were hiring. And that was the thing, you know, workers hiring workers.
And these guys were people who were members of the union in many cases, and they're fine, good people, you know. But you know how it is, you know. You have 5 acres of strawberries, you want 10, you got to hire more people, and you're going to pay them less so you can make more money. But last year, some of those guys made up to $50,000, $60,000, $40,000, $30,000. But in the process, there were some people there who paid not all, but some paid cheap wages. They hired illegals and paid cheap wages, because see, essentially the production is not cooperative. And there's no way of doing a cooperative, there's no way of doing a production cooperative unless you have tremendous discipline. We could do it in La Paz because we have that discipline, but very few groups could do it. They would bust up, they would fight, and they would destroy themselves. We've been together for several years working. This kind of lifestyle lends itself to the cooperative. If we were to just go into cooperatives, I tell you, in 10 years we would own 20,000, 30,000 acres, and we'd have all kinds of people. We would have vast parts of the industry owned by the workers, by the people. No problem. I know that. I know it would be. Because cooperatively, if you do the production cooperatively, you live cooperatively, you eat all of out of a common dining hall, and you have all the things that, the trappings that go with cooperatives, you know, there's no end what you can do. And I'm very excited about it, but, you know, it's not the time for me to do it. But I think I could do one. I know I could, and I know there would be a... So you do a model, and then people begin looking, and then begin to do it. When we started the union, there's now 1, 2, 3, 4, there's about 10 farm worker unions in the country now. There weren't any until we became successful, and we can do it too, and it's good, that's the way it happens.
I'm a little bit confused about why you feel this isn't the right time.
Well, I mean, for me, because I'm doing the union, I haven't got time to do it. But it's not, and I mean, this doesn't mean it's not the right time for somebody who would like to do it. This can be a more controversial than the union. We would be taking land and controlling stuff. We have a whole scheme where, I mean, I have a whole plan worked out to the T, you know. And someday if we have time, I'll tell you about it. I mean, now you talk about this and I go, it's like another led to another thing to cover. And it'll work. You talk to workers about land, and boy, the ice just, it's a different dimension. You're talking about wages and talking about rights, it's one thing. And they understand. We talk about land, and they really go like, I mean, you can see, like, boy, their eyes shine, and it's a different thing. It's a different thing.
Yours too.
Huh? Yours too. Yeah.
Are there other groups that you feel have the kind of equivalent resources and experience that the UFW has who could possibly initiate that kind of a large-scale cooperative venture?
Yeah, but not farm workers at once. There are other groups, mostly middle-class people who are already in communes that are there in viable organizations that are fed up with the rat race. And like there's a movement called the Back to the Earth movement. It's a growing movement. You have people like, it's happening mostly like out of the big population centers, like out of Manhattan, where a tax attorney maybe, an engineer maybe, a salesman, and people in high positions just get fed up with the rat race and just cash in, and they go out and go back to the land, buy 10, 15, 10 acres, 5 acres, and build a little place, and begin to live very down to earth, you know. And I've talked to many of them, I know many of them, and they say, look, I'm not rich, I'm poor, but I'm really happy. I have ulcers, and I'm going to live a long time. And they just admit that they just can't take the pressure. So those people could very well do it. And mostly religious people. There's a religious people, a group in California who's going to own someday 1 million acres of land, not too far from now. They're already into it. It's a semi-religious group. It's called the
Sunburst.
Or it's the Sunburst, and it's no, the Sun, something of the Sun. Brothers of the Sun. It's semi-religious. It's a brother, a Catholic religious, in a not a priest, but a brother, who started it. They have about 10,000 acres now. But the dream is, he had a vision that someday would own 1 million acres. They'll do it. They have interesting stuff. Let me just tell you a little bit about them. We're getting some ideas. I think we're going to do this someday soon. They have a ship. They bought one of those luxury liners, because you know they're not very expensive these days. And what they do, they use that, and they tour their people. They have like Latin American crews. They have like the cruise to the South Pacific. They have like the Northern cruise. They go to Europe and so forth. And what they do is they get people who have been in the movement for 10, 15 years, whatever, and say, okay, you go for 2 months, 3 months, 4 months. And they go, and they go to a port, and they anchor there, and they go and look at the sites, and they learn, and they do it, and they come back and sleep there and eat there in the ship. So it's very inexpensive. You can take a lot of them. But my idea would be to have the same thing, but to have a floating school. Say, for instance, we take 200-300 workers, okay, we're having the South America tour for 90 days or 60 days. While you're underway or you're traveling, you're in school, right? When you go, you say you dock in Acapulco, as an example, we take a couple of days to go look at the place and take pictures and know and see and study. Then you come back to the ship, when you start moving again, you start actually, you put them in school, so you do two, you accomplish two objectives at once. I'd like very much to do that. I think we can, a little while. So our people will be able to see things they'll never be able to see, but they'll also be students. Yeah, that's a lot of possibilities.
Do you see that, like, right now it's farm workers, but there's a lot of ideas and plans to getting into training programs for mechanics, painters, carpenter, electrical, all kinds of different things. Do you see that expanding?
No, all that only to the extent to meet the internal needs of the organization. And then that's one program. And that will be just to meet our needs, which are not that great. But the other program, separate from that, is what we call the apprenticeship training. It's going to be